Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr, and you are listening to Fiber Talk, that twice-weekly podcast. And I can take it right off of our guest's website. For hand embroidery is the art of stabbing something 20,000 times in order to relax. Outstanding. So our guest, Dana Batho of Peacock and Fig. Hi, Dana.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for joining us. I love that line, 20,000 times in order to relax. Yes.
Yeah. Like when people ask me what I do, I tell people like I help people relax by stabbing something 20,000 times, and they're all like, their face is hilarious. And they're like, wait, what? And they're like, are you like an acupuncturist or something? I'm like, no, I'm an embroidery designer. And they're like, oh, that makes so much more sense.
Yes. Yep. No, that's a good one there. I might just be borrowing that from you. So.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay.
Borrow away.
So, okay. But my first question, when going through your website, I saw cycling.
Yes.
And I do cycling. And so this is going to be a cycling show. No, not really, okay. but we're going to talk about it. So, okay. So, just so everybody knows, you had an injury while you were in the military and a medical discharge, and you have neck and shoulder and arm issues, and people can read about that on their website, but we do want to talk about how you compensate for that for stitching, but we'll get to that later. But part of it is then, so is cycling. You do cycling, but you use a recumbent?
Yes, that's correct. I've got a recumbent trike. It's an Ice Sprint FS, so it's fully suspended. It's pretty awesome, actually. Like, a friend of mine took it for a ride once, and she's like, oh, my God, it's like a deck chair on wheels. And I'm like, I know, right? And she's like, where do you put your beer? And I've got, like, a little – it's actually like a handlebag bar so I can rest my arm on it if I need to rest. And I'm like, what do you think the bag's for? And she's like, you are a genius.
So you have a tricycle, because I ride the conventional road bike and mountain bike. So – I've often wondered, I've never been able to talk to anyone who has one of these recumbents. And for those who don't know, recumbent is a bike that you basically sit down and like you're in a chair and you have your legs in front of you and you pedal it to the front there. So one of the things that people tell me, and we won't talk all about cycling, but I got to know, is that with these things going uphill is more of a challenge than with a standard bike. Is that the case?
Yeah, a little. Yeah. I mean, like most of them come standard with like 27, 30 gears ish, just because you do have to basically use spinning a lot more because you're basically almost like in a leg press position. If you try and push your way up the hill, like you would on a normal bike, you actually blow your knees out. Like it's really easy to hurt your knees because you've got your back up against the seat. And so you can actually put a lot of force behind your knees. So it's not advised to do that. So basically you learn how to go at a higher cadence, but then you're not pedaling as hard. So you might go up slower. But then you make up for it when you go down the hill because you're so much more aerodynamic than a normal diamond frame bike. So you can just like scream past the other cyclists if you're riding with them. So they're just like, whoa.
Yeah, that was my next question because I had a feeling that going downhill, you're flying. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Especially when Coco, my service dog, is in the back of it. So it's like his little cabana behind my head on a rear rack. And so he actually stands on the edge of the basket. So it looks like, from the front, it looks like he's standing on my shoulders. And he leans forward and his ears wing straight out. And he just, and it's hilarious. Like if I look straight up, his chin is over my head. It's hilarious. People are always like, oh my God, look at the dog. And he's all strapped, harnessed in and all that. So he can't go anywhere. But yeah, people just freak when they see us.
Now, you do a lot of cycling?
I haven't done much this summer. I haven't been feeling overly well. And like where it's parked in my parking garage in my building, it's just a little bit tricky to get out. And it's quite heavy. It's about 50 pounds, not including the dog and any water I put onto it or whatever. So it's just a little bit tricky to kind of maneuver by hand because it's lower to the ground. You know, it's not just like you wheel it out like a normal bike. You have to kind of pick it up and swing it around and things like that. So with my injury, sometimes it's actually hard to get it out. But once it's going, then it's fine.
Yeah.
Just getting it out is sometimes difficult.
Yeah, they just look like fun. There's a bike trail near me, and there's a group of recumbent riders, and they all ride up and down the trail, and they have a flag so people can actually see where they're at, and
yeah.
It looks like great fun. They're just sitting there in their chairs pedaling away and chatting and having a great time. So,
oh yeah, it's a ball. Like, I've got a big flagpole at back with like a million flags on the back, like all the countries I rode through with Wounded Warriors Canada a couple years ago. And then, you know, Coco's a little canopy. It's like actually a pet tent from the dollar store that I remade out of Canadian flags. So it helps keep him out of the sun when we're doing longer rides. And then it's also good for visibility for me as well. Yeah. But yeah, it's hilarious. Like, people are like, what is that?
Oh, that's great. And then I wanted to ask you, because I don't know of one around me. I'm sure there is. I've not found it. The Wounded Warrior thing, that whole effort really appeals to me, to the point, you know, where I'd like to get involved to whatever degree I could. What is that all about? How does that work?
Well, in Canada, it's Wounded Warriors Canada. There's a different organization in the U.S. called Wounded Warriors Project, and that's totally different organization. And I don't know if they do any kind of sporting type things, but I definitely know there are groups that do sporting, because with the Invictus Games and whatnot, there definitely are military groups that do sporting events and focus on the sporting aspect. But Wounded Warriors Canada, basically, they do this fundraiser ride every year where you have to raise a certain amount of money and you go overseas, usually to Europe, and you do a battlefield ride, and it's usually about a week, and you train for months and things like that, and then you go over there with your bike. Sometimes you can hire a bike there. I had to bring mine, obviously, because it's custom built for me. And then you ride across Europe and you stop at all these battlefields, and, you know, usually they have speakers and talk about each battle and the significance of it. So when I did it in 2015, we went from Vimy Ridge in France, which is like a huge Canadian war memorial. Like, it's just the most amazing place. It's really, really moving. So we started there, and then we rode through Belgium and like through Passchendaele and Flanders Field and all that. And then we rode into the Netherlands, and we ended at Nijmegen in the Netherlands, which is another big site of a Canadian cemetery. So, yeah, so that took about a week. And I didn't ride full days just because of my injury. And I'm not riding a 3-pound Cervelo racing bike. I've got like a 75-pound trike with a dog on the back. So I'd usually ride about 3/4 of the way and then get the food truck. Uh-huh. Would kind of put my trike in the back and take us to the next hotel or whatever.
Yeah, what a tremendous experience, though. Wow.
Yeah, it was amazing. Coco managed to bark at like all the Dutch sheep and all the Belgian carriage horses and all the French cows. Yeah, he had a ball.
Yeah, I was going to say, so Coco had the time of his life there, yes.
Oh, yeah. Everywhere we stopped, he'd pick up another little white dog boyfriend. It was hilarious. Like, he likes little white boy dogs. And I'm not even kidding. Everywhere we stopped, he would pick up another one. Like, in Belgium, the first night, there was like 4 of them there. They're all little boys. And I'm like, did you call people? Like, seriously, I don't even understand.
Well, that's great. That those kinds of programs are just fantastic. The one, and I don't know what it's called in the States, but the one that I know of, they do cycling events. And I know that a part of the program is to modify bikes so that wounded veterans can ride them, change the pedal, change the crank link, any number of things, so that they can ride and then do these rides to get them out. And
My trike was partially funded by Soldier On, which is an organization within the Department of National Defense. So they do the same sort of thing. Like, you can apply for funding, and depending on what you need and how much it costs, they'll give you either partial funding or full funding. And they've got events like the annual Army Run in Ottawa that they'll send you out to, and different training camps and whatever, depending on what you're doing. Like, if you want to go skiing at the local ski hill, sometimes they'll have like a ski event thing. So, yeah, it's quite good. Most of the events I can't participate in just because of my particular injury. Yeah. But yeah, no, it's a good organization, and they definitely helped me be able to afford to be able to buy the trike, because with all the customizations, it definitely wasn't cheap. But it's, you know, basically my car. I can't drive anymore because of the injury and whatnot. So.
Oh, so that is your way to get out and get around town then? Oh.
Yeah, for the most part. Like I'm lucky I live right downtown in Victoria. Like, I'm like a block from the Inner Harbor, so I'm really close to most shops. So I can, you know, if it's within a few blocks, it's easier for me to walk, just because, you know, then getting the trike out and unlocking it and putting the dog in and the whole thing. But if it's a longer distance, then it's I'll either take a cab or I'll ride the trike, depending on how I'm feeling and whatnot.
Yeah, oh, that's fantastic. Well, I had to learn about that, so thanks.
No worries.
Thanks for sharing that. Yeah, all right, so go ahead.
Rider on the ride, so on the battlefield ride. So yeah, everybody was like, see all these like cyclists, like we literally had an Olympian with us, and they're going really fast, and you see me with the dog and the trike, and everybody's like, well, that's different.
Yeah, those go fast guys. Yeah,
Yeah. We had a couple of those.
Yeah. They're everywhere. Yeah. I can ride, but I can't ride like that. Mm-mm.
That's right. I'd just laugh at them when they were at a light or whatever, and they'd fall over because they couldn't get their feet out of their clips fast enough because I'm reclined. I'm just like, I'm good.
Yeah. I'm just sitting here. I'm fine.
Yeah. I'm good.
Well, that's great. That's great. And that's, man, that would be fun to go tour battlefields in Europe.
Yeah, it was really moving. And we had Romeo Dallaire with us, who was a general. And, like, you know, he's got a bunch of books out, and like, including his time in Rwanda as a commander and just basically watching a genocide happen in front of him. And it was just brutal. So having him and his wife there was really, really amazing. So, yeah, they're really moving experiences. Like, the actual, like, cycling and the trip itself is cool as well. But just where you're going and why you're going is pretty awesome, too.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. That's great. All right. I've learned something. Now, needlework. I have to learn things. Simply have to learn things. All right, so needlework. So you start as an artist, painter. Is that's where your origins are, is doing artwork?
Yeah, pretty much. Like, I've always kind of done a lot of different types of art, like drawing, and I didn't really get a lot into painting. Like, I did some, but it wasn't until I kind of discovered oils after art school, of course. Like, during art school, I hated painting because we'd only use acrylics. Turns out I just hate acrylics. but yeah, like, I've always done, my mom was really crafty, taught me how to do some embroidery when I was a kid. She actually, ironically, still doesn't know how to cross stitch. So I must have picked that up on my own at some point when I was a kid with a kit or something random. But yeah, like drawing and crafting and just making random stuff. And So
that was part of your life from the get-go then.
Yeah, pretty much. And then when I was in New Zealand, I went to art school down there for 4 years, and that was really neat. It was like almost like an art school / technical college. So it was sort of more hands-on, and because it was in New Zealand, there was a lot of Polynesian influence. So you could learn some of the local different types of art and things like that, and the crafts. Like, I'm actually a really good weaver with flax and like doing traditional Maori weaving and things like that. Like, I actually got taught by a traditional weaver, which was kind of unusual. Usually they wouldn't teach like the white girl. But, a friend of mine kind of stood in for me, and she's like, no, you teach her. She's the one standing in front of you asking to learn, so you teach her. So. Yeah,
so New Zealand, a military family that you moved around a lot?
My dad was in the Canadian Navy, and he got off his ship in Australia and then ended up in New Zealand. And then that's how I ended up with two passports. So my mom's Kiwi.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I was born in New Zealand and ended up back in Canada when I was 2. And then went back when I was 19 and stayed for like 8-9 years.
Oh, what fun. That's one of the few places over. I'm not a very good overseas traveler, and that is one of the few places, New Zealand, Australia, that I would actually make the effort to go to.
It was pretty awesome. Like, when I was down there, they were filming all the Lord of the Rings stuff. So my roommate was one of the director's assistants, and my best friends was an elf extra. So he had to dye his eyebrows blonde, and we constantly teased him about that because he looked like he had no eyebrows. And, you know, so it was great. And, like, you know, they'd be filming, like, you know, just around the corner from your house type thing, or like on the way to work. It's like, it's a quarry, but all in the movie, it's, you know, Mordor. It's like where the volcano is erupting, and, you know, it's actually just a quarry, you know, stuff like that.
Let's see, on the resume, elf extra.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's great. So you really have, from the beginning, a lot of art and fiber art. Boy, you got the whole mix there early on. And obviously it stuck with you.
Yeah, exactly. And in art school, too, I was really focused on printmaking because we had some really good printing presses. And then we had some really neat textile artists as well. And ironically, I'm still in touch with some of my professors from that school. And they really encouraged us to experiment. And I really wanted to figure out a way to print my drawings onto silk and onto fabric, but not using the traditional like t-shirt transfer crap that makes it all sticky and gross. And it took me about 6 months of playing with chemicals and almost blowing things up until I figured out how to do it. And my teacher was just floored. She's like, I didn't know you could do that. And I'm like, well, apparently I invented a new technique. So there you go.
Hey, that's great. That's great.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're stitching, you're learning fiber arts, all through school and all through the military?
Yeah, like when I joined the military, because I'd lived overseas for so long, like after New Zealand, I came back to Canada for a few years, worked in tourism in Banff and Lake Louise, and that's when 9/11 happened. And so I had a lot of time to learn to do something. And most of my friends were Japanese because we were all worked in retail. So I learned some Japanese and ended up in Japan teaching for 3-4 years. And that's when I sort of got interested in potentially working for the Canadian government, because I'd lived overseas for so long, and it was just, and I ended up volunteering with the Canadian embassy. So I was just like, well, you know, maybe I should do this whole working for Canada thing. I mean, I've been around enough to sort of know what it's like, you know, as a Canadian looking, you know, back to Canada from other countries. And, you know, I kind of really appreciated sort of what Canada was all about, and, you know, the values and whatnot. So I thought about doing the diplomatic route, but then you had to go back to school anyway. And diplomatic exams are notoriously hard. Like, you know, you never know whether you're going to get in or not. And then I came back to Canada for Christmas, because I always came back home for Christmas. And my dad's like, well, why don't you join the military and go to the military college? And then they pay for your education, and then you don't have to get another student loan. So I was up to my eyeballs in student loan debt from two countries, the joys of dual citizenship. And yeah, and then ended up sort of started thinking about it. And he's like, you know, you could go into intelligence or something, because I was, because in Japan, the only sort of English channel we could get that wasn't garbage was CNN. So, you know, you're just watching CNN all the time, and all the news and all the terrorism stuff and Afghanistan and all that. And sort of got quite interested. So, yeah, so I ended up finishing up my time in Japan and coming back to Canada and applying for the military. And thankfully, I got in.
Boy, try and do more before you're 30 than anyone else on the planet.
Seriously, right? Well, it was a funny thing. When I went to RMC, to the military college here in Canada, it's the equivalent of like West Point and Annapolis and everything all rolled into one. We don't have a separate one for Army, Navy, Air Force. It's all one college. But like in the first year, we had, you know, they sort of told us like it's going to get really stressful and stuff, so make sure you take time to kind of relax, you know, in the 10 minutes of the day that you have to. So I started doing some paintings for our squadron lounge, because our squadron lounge was shared with another squadron. So our sort of mascot, if you want to say, was General Wolf, and he was, you know, Canadian historical figure. And then the other one was General Joseph Brand. And so I thought it would be neat to do some portraits of these two for the squadron lounge. This is a little project for me, and sort of some downtime from studying and running around and doing hill sprints at 6 a.m., which is super not fun.
Yeah, I'm not signing up for that. No.
No, I wasn't. I'm not a runner, but the military loves making you run. But yeah, it was funny. So I once, like, for an hour a night, I'd go down to the lounge and pull out the paintings and start working on them. And, you know, my squadron leaders and stuff like that would come down, like the third and fourth year cadets, and they just come down and they'd go, why are you here? And I'm like, I don't know. It seemed like a good idea at the time. So yeah, even while I was still at the military college and stuff, I still kind of kept up my art as much as I could. Like, it was hard because, you know, there's only so much space, and obviously you're getting room inspections, you know, easels and stuff are not exactly part of the room standard.
No, I'm sure not. Yeah.
So I kind of had to keep everything in the lounge, because otherwise I would get, you know, nailed during inspection. Like, what's this paintbrush?
Ah! Oh, so that's how you did it. You left the mess in the lounge, and then your room was clean. Okay.
Yeah. Because they basically gave me a special little locker to lock stuff up, so that, you know, the oil paints and stuff didn't get, you know, stolen, or, you know, just go disappearing or something like that, random. Right. You know, somebody sniffing the glue or whatever. So.
Work the system. My room has to be clean, but not the lounge. All right.
Yep.
Did you get the paintings finished?
Yeah, I did, actually. And it was neat because one of the maintenance guys on campus was actually a pretty decent framer. So he actually framed them up and then put them into the lounge and put some nice lights over them. So they actually look really cool. So, yeah, it was neat going down to the lounge after that and seeing my paintings.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah, they're still there.
Are they still? They still are, huh? Oh,
yep.
Great.
Yeah.
So that, yeah, so that gives you a little break, a little mental escape, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Because you just kind of needed it. I mean, like the military college, I mean, you've got your language requirements, because you had to be bilingual by the time you were finished. You had your academic, your military stuff, and your physical fitness stuff. So it was a lot. And then they throw all this random stuff at you just to see if you can handle it, like leadership roles. And, oh, by the way, tomorrow you're in charge of the change of command parade. Surprise!
Oh. You know,
stuff like that. Here's the drill manual, like a couple hundred pages. Memorize that for tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, hey. trying not to screw up in front of the entire cadet wing.
Yeah, no pressure there.
Yeah, no pressure. Yeah, and the general's coming, oh, by the way. Oh, good. Yeah, great.
Oh, boy. Yeah. So then you you have your injury and get discharged, and now you want to continue your art, but just physically difficult then, huh?
Yeah, it is. Like, when I got hurt, like, it took me probably about 2 years to realize that I could still do stuff, but in a different way, because I can't be upright and I can't, like, look down. And usually when you're painting or drawing or whatever, you're looking down. And so I can't really do that, even reading books. Like, I was halfway through my master's degree when I got hurt, and even just, like, reading my textbooks and stuff was brutally hard. But then it took me a while to kind of figure out that I could still do this stuff. It just had to be in an adapted way. So I would like draw on tablets because I could have them at sort of a different angle and a different height. And my computer's on like a swinging stand over me, so it's not actually on a table. So I'm like on a chaise lounge. So I'm all stretched out pretty much all day with heat on my neck. And now I actually just started using a Wacom tablet. So that's in my lap when I draw, and so I can look straight ahead at my computer screen and see what I'm doing, which is super handy.
I see. So basically the injury forces you to have everything at eye level or a little higher so that you don't have to tilt your head.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Yes.
And so then once you make that adaptation, then you're able to do what you want to do. You just have to be different about it.
Pretty much. Yeah. And like, I can't, like, certain crafts I can't do anymore, like knitting and crochet, because you just use too much of your shoulders. Whereas with stitching, it's mainly just your wrists. So that doesn't really bring my shoulders and stuff into it. And I've got like a Lowry stand next to me that I can swing over my lap if I want to do some stitching. Cause then, you know, I'm not having to hold the hoop. Sometimes it's easier for me just to stitch in hand without a hoop. But yeah, so I've got kind of everything kind of surrounded around me. So like, you know what, I just moved into a slightly bigger apartment, and I was debating about whether to have like an actual office space. And I'm like, well, what's the point? I'm going to have to get like a second couch that's going to sit there with my computer over me anyway. It's like, it's my couch. This is my office. It's my couch. It's fine.
Well, I think, you know, it's unfortunate that you have this, but also I think there's an education for, because so many people who stitch have all kinds of maladies, wrists, mm-hmm. arms, shoulders, and ergonomics is, you know, the usually that's what the result is poor ergonomics. And you've basically had good ergonomics forced on you.
Yeah.
So stand makes a difference. And I loved reading the story about how you, you had your dad, make legs for your stand.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's neat. Yeah. I still got that one too. I've got a couple other stands that people have given me and stuff in the meantime. Like I've got a couple little lap stands and whatnot, but yeah, I do like the Lowry stand just cause I can kind of move it away from me and sort of tilt it up against. I've got some shelving next to me, which is what my computer, sort of holder clamps onto. But so that's quite nice because it's not taking up a lot of space. Like I like the lap stands, but sometimes, you know, when you put it down, it's like, okay, now it's taking up half the floor.
Right.
You
know? Right.
So I do like the Lowry because you can just kind of swing it out of the way, which is handy. But even before I got released, like I started stitching this big project just to sort of testing my software that I was using and just seeing how well it rendered some of my drawings. And started stitching that, and it was actually really helpful because like just the whole release process is really, really stressful. And because I was in pain all the time, and you know, obviously really upset about having worked so hard to get into my career, and then you know, sort of getting right. booted out of it before I could even really do much with it. So yeah, the stitching was really, really therapeutic. So that's when I really started thinking about, you know, because I knew I'd have to do something when I released. Like I wasn't just going to be the type of person just to sit on, you know, the few benefits that you get and watch TV all day. Like that's not me. So I was like, okay, well, how can I, you know, help other people learn, you know, how relaxing it is and how you can kind of, especially if you're going through something really stressful, it's just like sort of a nice quiet time and you can't think about anything else when you're stitching. Cause if you do, you screw up and then you recount and then you swear a lot and you go grab more wine and, you know, so you kind of have to focus on what you're doing.
Oh, wait, swearing and wine are involved?
Yeah.
Well,
Wait, that's not just me? Oh.
Maybe I need to work the whine in. I got the swearing part, but maybe I need to work the whine in. I'm missing half the game here. Okay.
I know. Well, actually, once a week in my building, I started a Stitch and Bitch group. So we meet downstairs in our building lobby once a week, and we all bring wine or flasks of some random assortment and Stitch. And sometimes, it's really funny. Sometimes people are talking and drinking, and then they're like, ah, nuts, and they have to count because they miscount, so busy talking and drinking.
Yeah. So you're spreading the disease then?
Yeah, pretty much.
That's great. Yeah,
I'm doing the best I can.
How many in the building, Stitch?
There's probably about 5 of us that come down fairly regularly.
Ooh, a good group then.
Oh. Yeah, so it's fun. So, and it's funny too, because the rest of the not every resident, but a lot of them know that, Thursday nights is Stitch and Bitch night. So, if they want to come in and watch a hockey game or something on the TV that's down in the lounge, it's like, well, you're going to be doing it over us yapping. So you're free to come down and use the room, but we're just going to be sitting there yapping away. So
glad to have you along for the ride, but
exactly. It's like, you want to learn to stitch? I'll teach you to stab something. It's all good. I won't say the word that I use for all the new stitches. I've taught a few of them how to stitch because they didn't know, but they're like, oh, I'll come along. So, but there's a little special word that I, have a little pattern for that I made, and everybody has chosen to start with that word. I'm like, that's awesome. Yeah, it's a special word. Uh-huh. But yeah, it's pretty, because it's nice and just graphic and, not too many stitches. They can kind of figure out like how to count and, how to skip a stitch and things like that. So, and then they end up with it. And I'm just like, hey, look what you just made.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's, it really is. We've talked about this many times on podcasts and it's really hard to describe, but that when you get immersed in the stitching and just everything just kind of falls away. And because you do have to focus, and I watching some floss, watching floss tube videos, and how many times that people were doing a stitch with me and they, oh no, I messed up. I got to pull these stitches out, and cause they're trying to talk stitch and at the same time. And, but it's just amazing how no matter what the stitching technique, it has the same impact for everyone. It's just that escape.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like that repetitive motion just over and over and over. You just keep moving. And it's like same with knitting and crochet, anything where you're kind of like, it's like sort of a nice repetitive motion. It seems like it almost, puts your mind at ease.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just one of, I don't know too many hobbies like that. I mean, I do get that. I do get that with cycling where I use it to work through problems. But then I'll reach a point, say if I'm on a 3-hour ride, I'll reach a point where, all right, I've thought about those things, and then my mind just goes blank, and then it's just turning the cranks and just moving. And there's nothing quite like that. It just, I'm not, you can't get to me, folks.
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to ask, so your mom never learned to cross stitch?
No, she taught me some basic embroidery stuff. Like our only sort of family photo from the 70s was like all of us wearing clothes that my mom embroidered and made herself, which was hilarious. So she taught me some basic embroidery, and then I must have like grabbed a cross stitch kit from like, there was a little local craft shop before it closed down, and I must have grabbed something from there and taught myself to cross stitch because I don't remember learning it at all. And then I hadn't picked it up in probably about 20 years at least before I sort of got the idea like, hey, maybe I can turn some of my art into patterns and then, sell the patterns or just see what it's like just to stitch up my art as a pattern.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's just interesting that someone who can teach embroidery to her daughter doesn't cross stitch. Cause usually that's, one of the things people start with.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure she can figure it out. Cause like she makes like hats and sells them and,
oh my.
And all this kind of stuff, like little toques and stuff like that. She's really crafty and whatnot, but yeah, I'm sure she could figure it out, but she just, especially like ordering fabric and all that kind of stuff. Like they don't have it. She lives on a tiny little island. She doesn't even have internet in her house. They have to go to the resource center if she wants to use internet. And yeah, it's cute. Like one of those little remote islands, and they love it up there, but I'm just like, nope, 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 not for me. Nope. I'm right downtown.
Right there. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
I'm good.
Yeah. So what flips the switch that makes you want to design? You just, is it literally is, I got to do something. I got to find a way to bring in a few extra bucks. I'm an artist. Let's see if we can't make this work with needlework.
Yeah, probably a bit of everything. Like, I started teaching the tutorials and stuff, which was hilarious because, like, I would learn something and then do a tutorial about it. So, you know, Excellent. Even now I get a lot of people going, oh, you know so much. And it's like, well, I mean, I've been doing it for a couple of years now, especially I've got like over 70 tutorials on YouTube. So, I mean, I have learned stuff along the way, but, you know, it's like, I wasn't born knowing all this stuff. I just learned it. And then I taught it pretty much straight away. It's like, oh, I want to teach a tutorial about that stitch, but I don't know how to do it. So I'm going to learn it and then I'm going to teach it.
Yep. So that's as a former teacher. Yeah. That's the quickest way to learn something is to try and teach it. Yep. Because you have to anticipate all the things that go wrong. Yep.
Yeah. Well, even in Japan, it was funny. Like, the students would ask you, like, just random questions. And I had the most brilliant answer for them. They always thought I was a genius and it just was a cover for I had no idea. But they would say something like, oh, Dana-sensei, what about this when this happens? Like, why does it do that? Like, why do you use this word instead of this word? And I'm like, actually, that's a really good question, and I'm going to write it down so I don't forget you asked it, but we're actually going to cover that next week, so good on you. You're ahead of the game. You're thinking ahead. That's awesome. And then I'd go look it up. And they were always like, oh, she knows everything. She's so prepared. And I'm like, I have no idea.
Excellent.
I have no idea. English is weird.
Just fake it and delay.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, that's a great question. We're actually going to cover that next week. Yeah,
and they're like, right here. It's right here in the lesson plan. Yeah, look right here.
Yeah. And they're like, and then they think they're like super genius because they kind of anticipated what was coming next.
Yep.
Yeah, it's a win for everybody.
Excellent. If I were still teaching, I would apply that. That'd be good. Yeah. So you have these designs, and you got to. So then you got to learn some software, get a computer so you can work on it. What was that? That process had to have been a lot of trial and error then.
Yeah. Like, my first pattern I designed was actually like a painting. It's like a digital painting I did of a statue of David. It's like sort of half of his face type thing. It's pretty cool. This is going to sound totally ridiculous, but it's the only way I could figure out at the time, because I didn't even know the software was out there, because I hadn't really looked into it that much. But I went to a photocopy shop and I got the painting printed onto a clear sheet of acetate, like we would use for an overhead projector.
Mm-hmm.
And then I took that to, there used to be a little needlework shop. This is when I was living in Ottawa, right downtown. So I went down there and I literally just compared this little photocopy to all the floss colors. And I didn't even know you're supposed to get all the same type of floss, like DMC versus Anchor. I was just grabbing floss. I was like, I don't care. And just sort of comparing colors. And I sort of grabbed about 15, 20 colors. And I had no idea how much I would need of each one. So I'm just like, yeah, those look like about the right colors, comparing it to my little photocopy. And grabbed some fabric. And I was just like, didn't even know what kind of fabric I grabbed. And literally what I did is I can't even remember if I had a hoop. And I would put the acetate in front of the fabric, and I'd kind of taped it at the back so it kind of flip over and backwards, and I'd put it over and I'd be like, okay, I think this next three stitches are going to be this purple, and then I'd stitch those, and the next one is going to be this. And that's how I worked, and it took me like a month to do like a 4x6 little stitching project. And it's not bad. Like, it looks a little wonky. It definitely doesn't look, you know, as good as the original painting, but I was pretty happy with it. And then I'm like, okay, this is ridiculous. Like, there has to be a better way to do this. Cause I was like, I am not going to like try and graph out on a piece of graph paper with like 15 different pencil crayon colors and remember which ones eat. Like, no, I'm like, no, there has to be a simpler way. And then I started looking into software, and so luckily there was software available. So I just downloaded the first one that was available for Mac that I could find, which was MacStitch. And got the demo, and then uploaded another painting that I did, and it comes out with the preview image, and I'm like, oh, that's so much better, so much faster, you know. And then it's just all the trial and error figuring out like how to use the software, because there's a sort of a misconception that you just put images into the software and boom, out comes the perfect pattern. And I know there's some companies that do that, and I'm not going to say who it is, but anyway, you do need to, like, especially if you're, you know, a designer, an artist. I mean, sometimes the software you know, will bring in different color temperatures, or like say like all of your greens are say like a cool green, like mints and things like that. And then all of a sudden there's this random mustard green thrown in there because it just couldn't quite register that color, right? Because maybe you're trying to get your pattern, you know, small enough size that somebody's not going to want to shoot you. So, you know, you have to adapt the colors, or, you know, hand alter some of the details, like in a face or something like that. Like the first big one that I did was my, I called it Shades of Grace. It's like a black and white chalk and charcoal drawing on to black paper. And I imported that. And then I wanted to kind of experiment and see how few colors I could get away with. So I limited the colors to only 8 colors. And then it's a 14 by 20 inch on 14 count. And I really wanted to see if it could kind of pick up the stroke lines and things like that of my original drawing. And it's like one of Michelangelo's figures on the Sistine Chapel ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing hard or anything. And, yeah, so then I had to do a little bit of hand alteration and stuff and change a few colors out and whatnot. But, yeah, it came out really, really good. So I'm like, I could work with this. So, yeah, that's when I started working with that software. And then, of course, you know, doing tutorials on it, as you do, you know, to help other people, especially because I think at the time that might have been the only Mac software that was available.
There's more than one, because that's the only one I've ever heard of.
What the heck's it called? Cross Stitch Professional or something like that, like one of the more expensive ones that does have a Mac version, but you know, it's like a couple $100 to buy. And at the time I was like, I didn't know what I wanted to do with, you know, whether I wanted to make it a profession or just play and see how it went and stuff like that. So the Mac Stitch one was the first one I tried, and I just liked it. And the developer is always updating it and things like that, which is great. So, yeah, I think that's now, like, you know, looking at some of the more professional ones, and I look at the features of Mac Stitch and WinStitch. WinStitch is the Windows version of the same thing. They're pretty comparable. I mean, there's a few minor differences, and people who, like, I've got friends who sell patterns, and they actually like license artwork from the artists, and then they create the patterns, and they sort of do hand adjusting just to make sure the colors are right and the details are right compared to the art and things like that. And quite often they'll do it in a couple of different softwares, just because, you know, one will render the colors a bit better, one will do this a bit better, and they'll kind of like mix and match them until they get their finished pattern, which is cool. I just use the one version of the software because I just like it to be a little bit more simple of a process, especially because it's my own designs too, so I can just change it up how I want. I'm not trying to replicate somebody else's art.
Right. Yeah. You can be a little more adaptable that way. Yeah.
So you
learn the software. Then are you creating? You're still creating art in some way on paper or canvas, or do you just start doing these designs right in the software?
It depends on what I'm working on. Like some collections, the vintage Sass collection, that was actually based on a really cool graphics pack that I got. It was like all this vintage illustrations of animals and all kinds of stuff. Actually, there were two collections I did that were kind of based on vintage stuff. But yeah, I had this like really neat like graphics. It has like fonts and illustrations like out of old encyclopedias and atlases and things like that. And you can buy this sort of bundle of, you know, a couple thousand illustrations.
Yeah.
Creative Market is a terrible, terrible place if you enjoy, you know, not having to pay your credit card bill. Yeah. It's so dangerous if you're into design or fonts or anything like that. Like you can just watch your money just getting sucked right out of your wallet, but it's awesome. But yeah, so I use all these kind of like illustrations and stuff as sort of inspiration. And some of them, like I would do a mock-up in Photoshop and then import it into the software and then clean up the image. Cause you know, of course, I wanted my patterns small enough they could be stitched. So, you know, usually around 100 by 100-ish is about the biggest most of my patterns are. There are some that are bigger, like obviously like the big one I was just talking about. But for the most part, I try to keep them ish around there just because I know most people are busy and they don't want to get stuck behind a project that's going to take them 3 years. You know, they want to sort of get that, you know, see actual progress, and then like they start and then they can see the middle and then they're done. You know, some of the bigger projects, it's harder to see that sort of consistent progress. So
right, yeah, I don't know if it really is a trend that I'm seeing, or if it's just my, you know, just my exposure and perception. But it seems like that people are getting more and more leaning more and more towards smaller projects,
mm-hmm.
and I assume that's just because of that kind of that instant gratification, I can get it done in my lifetime type of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, and I think too a lot of people now, like, they're seeing stuff on Instagram, especially embroidery. Like, embroidery on Instagram is huge, and some of the photographs are just amazing. But yeah, I mean, like, they, you know, they're small enough to be held in your hand, and then, you know, I think a lot of people are making them for gifts, or, you know, maybe they're students, or, you know, they've just got their, you know, first job, and they don't have like the huge house that has a huge amount of wall space. You know, they just want something small that they can hang up, or, you know, stick in their cubicle hidden behind a plant if it's got, you know, something funny or nasty on it or whatever, so their boss doesn't see it and yell at them. But, you know, I think a lot of people, like, it depends on the stitcher, obviously, but a lot of people seem to enjoy the slightly smaller patterns, because, you know, they can kind of do them fast and see progress. Like, there was a mermaid stitch along I did recently, and it was really, really rude and snarky, and it was hilarious. But I had one woman that, like, every month it was four patterns, and every month I'd release a new one, and literally within 24 hours of me releasing that pattern, she'd have it done and posted in my Facebook group, and she's like, I'm done. We're like, how? Like, they're small, but that's insane. Like, there's beads and there's krennic, and we're like, oh my god. She's like,
do you sleep?
I know. We're like, holy, that's amazing.
Now, most of you have a real mixture in your designs, cross stitch and embroidery. Do you lean one way or the other, or is it just whatever strikes you?
I just started doing the embroidery side of things, just because I think some designs suit embroidery better, especially, like, if I'm trying to do something that's got a lot of detail and I don't want it to get massive. That's because some of the designs, like, you know, especially if I want a lot of detail, like, say, in a face, or, like, say, in an animal or something like that, or, like, a flower or something, the choices either go really big for the pattern, or, you know, use a higher thread count. And, you know, a lot of the stitchers who, you know, like, buying my stuff don't want to go crazy on, like, 28 count over one type thing. It's either that, to get a lot of the detail, or, you know, kind of just, you know, sort of mute the details almost. And I do a lot of stuff where it's just kind of like a wash of color, and then the backstitch outline kind of around it. So it almost looks like a watercolor that's been inked over with a pen. Mm-hmm. So the color lines kind of don't match up with the backstitch lines, so it looks like sort of looser, like a watercolor drawing type thing. So I quite like that style. But yeah, I just found with the embroidery, it was fun, and it was nice too, getting some texture in there as well. So the most current collection is a mix of embroidery and cross stitch patterns, and there's actually two patterns that are both. So they're mainly cross stitch, but then there's embroidered roses on them, and they're woven wheel roses, and they're so easy to do. People look at them and they're like, "Oh, that's so hard." I'm like, "No, seriously, so easy. You make a star with your floss, and then you wind it round and round and round, and that's it. Like, it's stupid simple." So yeah, I just thought it'd be neat to sort of mix them in, to kind of encourage people as well to try something new, because I know cross stitchers tend to kind of get into their mode of, I just want to cross stitch, because, you know, it is quite repetitive, and because you got your fabric with the holes all in it, and you kind of just keep going, and you've got your grid with every stitch laid out, whereas embroidery is a little looser, it's a little freer. You can, once you get your line drawing onto your fabric, you can kind of do whatever you want. You can change the stitches up how you like, change the colors, you know, it's a lot sort of looser. So some people don't like that. They want to be told which color to put where and which stitch and all that. So with the new collection, I've got four that are purely embroidery patterns, and I've done, like, the pattern so that, you know, it's like almost like a stitch map inside, where, you know, here's the color for this one that you can use, that I used in the picture, and here's the stitch I used. But then I explain in the notes, it's like, you can switch this up to whatever you like, you know, and I've got links to my tutorials, so if they don't know how to do a certain stitch, and they're all really simple, basic stitches. I haven't done anything crazy with them, because I wanted to keep them accessible to new embroiderers, or people who haven't really maybe done much embroidery, or they haven't done it in a long time. So yeah, it's sort of a choice just to kind of try mixing in another needlecraft, and, you know, just see how people received it, and whether, you know, I could get people to kind of cross over to both sides, and, or if they're just going to stick with the cross stitch. So yeah, it's been an interesting experiment so far.
Yeah. And I should point out, folks, definitely spend some time with Dana's YouTube channel, all kinds of tutorials there. Sucked up a couple of my hours, I'll tell you that. But no, I mean, you really do have a broad selection of how-to tutorials, really well done. So people should use that resource. It's very nice.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I just like being able to help people and stuff like that. And some of them, you know, they're I might be featuring a pattern, and then, you know, you have to sign up to my email list to get access to the pattern. And I used to offer the patterns just for free, like you could just download them off my site. And then I'm like, well, this is kind of silly. Like, I'm spending literally like 3 days or 4 days making a tutorial, making the pattern, doing the sample stitching. I'm like, you know, at least somebody can at least give me their email address to access the patterns. So I've got like about 15 or so patterns now for free on my site. Some of them are, most are cross stitch, but there are some embroidery ones too that go with the tutorials. So, and you know, and every infrequently I add to them and stuff like that. Like, I don't have a set schedule of when I put new freebies in the collection. That just sort of whenever I have time to chuck in something new, or you know, there's a tutorial I specifically want to do and I create a pattern that goes with that to sort of illustrate the technique. So yeah, it's been good. People really like the freebies.
Yeah, that's something that I've said before, is people need to explore designer sites, because there often are free designs that will give you a chance for cost of thread and time to dabble in something you may not have tried. And people really need to take advantage of that. And then, for instance, you know, use your free designs. Hey, I enjoy that. And then go into the ones you pay for and see that there's more of that, or variations on the theme. It really is a good way to experiment and you know, just try things. Because you're right. I mean, we all do that. We get stuck in a rut, and you know, cross stitchers, needle pointers, whatever, and that's, you know, this is what I do. And then you'll hear, oh geez, I'm just tired. I don't have any enthusiasm to stitch anymore. And I don't know if I need a break, but I want to stitch. And my reaction is, go try something else.
Yeah.
Go try embroidery. Go try cross stitch. Go try hardanger, and put a challenge in front of yourself, and you might find a new channel, and or you might just regain your enthusiasm for what you've been doing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's why I like sort of doing a variety of tutorials and stuff like that. And like, I've had a few people ask me for like more blackwork tutorials, and I'm like, I barely know anything about blackwork myself, so I don't really feel confident in teaching that. But I've got a couple of basic ones that sort of showing people what it is and sort of how you would normally work a pattern and things like that. But it's like, yeah, I'm no blackwork designer, and like, you know, like I'm considering putting a little bit into a few designs I've got upcoming for some magazines and stuff, but it's sort of more stylized. Like, I wouldn't ever consider calling myself a blackwork designer, just because it's a totally different art form all on its own, and it's beautiful. But cracks me up is when people say, I hate backstitch, but I like blackwork. I'm like, but it's the same thing. I don't understand. It's like, I've never understood why people hate backstitch. I'm like, it's literally a half stitch, a half cross stitch that's got navigational issues. It's kind of going all over the place.
There it is. There's your definition right there.
Yeah. It's like, I don't understand why. It's like, it goes faster. You're almost finished. If you're doing the backstitch, you're probably almost finished. You maybe have beading to do or whatever after that, and that's it. It's like, I've never understood why people don't like backstitch.
A half cross stitch with navigational issues. Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent. All right, now we're going to run out of time here, but I got to ask about the Go Bloom Yourself collection, because you gave me more than a chuckle out of that one.
Yeah, there's a couple really special ones in there. When I was designing it, I was showing some of my proofs to some of my friends, and I had one tell me that she almost sprayed her computer with coffee when she read it. And she was like, oh my God. It's like, yeah, I know, I'm special.
Yeah, no, had that same reaction myself. So basically, I just love the play on words, and it's, you know, we try to keep this family friendly here, but, like, go pollinate yourself.
That one's pretty popular right now. Yeah. And the sit on a thorn one's pretty popular as well.
Yes. Oh yes. There's so many of them. They're really good. So, but it's, they're nice designs too. That's the fun part for me, is you've got these nice floral wreath designs and then these words in the middle. And then once you absorb the words, then the whole thing just kind of goes into another dimension.
Yeah. And I purposely designed those ones too, because I've got a few people on my email list who don't like swear words or even the implication of swear words. And so I'm just like, you know, these are all designed. You can do them completely without the words and they're still look really beautiful, or you can change up the words, do whatever you want. I was like, you know, because I want people to kind of, you know, do their own thing with them as well. Like, you know, you don't have to strictly stick to the pattern. So I really enjoy that. But I, yeah, same, like, that's exactly the vibe I'm kind of going for. I like the sort of the really beautiful, elegant, you know, so modern, like with sort of modern colors and things like that. Like, you're never going to see me do a country cottage, or, you know, it's never going to happen unless it's on a spoof on something. But yeah, I like that kind of play between the sort of the really elegant, pretty designs and then the words, because there's a lot of designers that do really snarky patterns, but they're usually quite simple patterns, and I love them. I think they're awesome and they're perfect for beginners who are sort of not very confident in their stitching or whatever, but I just wanted to go a little bit different direction and kind of mix the really, really pretty with the really snarky. And not all of them are snarky, but a fair whack of them are, and they seem to be the ones that a lot of my customers really resonate with, like the mermaid one. Yeah, the little promotional thing I put out for that was just like little snippets of some of the images. Couldn't even see it. And I sold so many just based on what I said. I won't say it, but just based on the image of like little snippets of some of the krennic and the beads and stuff like that. And then the little tagline I had for that collection. And people just lost their minds. They're like, shut up and take my money.
Yeah, well, they're very creative. And I love the embroidery. A lot of these are embroidery and not difficult.
No, they're really not difficult. Like I only picked up embroidery again to do this collection and to do the tutorials. So I mean, like, I haven't been embroidering, like, you know, like I said, I learned when I was a little kid, but I hadn't done it in so long. And so, I mean, yeah, they're all really simple stitches. And I specifically did the tutorials so that they would match up with the pattern. So it's like, okay, here's how to do a straight stitch, and here's how to do it in the pattern. Like, this really, really simple stitches. I really wanted to make them accessible so people can, you know, they don't feel intimidated. Like, some of the stuff you see on Instagram, you're like, oh, that's amazing, but I could never do that. Like, the ones that are the embroidery that's being done on like clear like vellum and things like that, where you can see right through it, it's like, that's awesome, but that's really hard to do.
Those people, I just sit there with my jaw on the floor, like, wow.
Yeah, or like the needle painters. Like, there's one I follow, Stitching Sabbatical, and she's great, but she has like pet portraits, but just like one thread at a time, like building up the whiskers and the face and the eyes and the shine in the eye. It's like, wow, that's amazing. But, you know, so I try to keep my designs sort of simpler, but still really pretty. And I like the mix of textures and stuff that embroidery gives, because they almost turn into like a little 3D painting almost.
Yeah. And now you show these all on your site in a hoop. Is that, say, an 8-inch hoop?
I'm just trying to think. Cross-stitch ones are 8-inch hoops, and the embroideries are in 6-inch hoops.
Okay, so these are stick-in-your-purse, take-along-with-you type things. No problem.
Yeah, exactly.
That.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's why I like sort of most of my designs being a bit on the smaller side, just because, like, they're not, like, miniature, but, you know, because then they're portable. Like, I had one woman do, like, I've got a four-panel design called Solarized Dahlia that's really popular, and it's just four different panels of the same flower, but they're all in slightly different color tones. And, you know, and you can do them, each panel individually or as one bigger piece, but she had like one panel in her car for when she was, you know, taking her kid to soccer or whatever. She brought one with her to Mexico. So she sent me this hilarious picture of her legs with her cross stitch in her lap and then the ocean in Mexico. And I was like, that's awesome.
You Excellent. Know? Okay. Yeah. Yes. Now I wanted to ask you about that, the Solarized Dahlia, because I was, that one really catches my eye. I mean, it's really a stunning thing. So this is four different.
Like, it's actually four individual patterns that, like, now I sell it as a set. Like, I used to sell them individually, but people would just keep buying it as a set. So now it's just a set. But you can stitch them individually, and you can put them like horizontally on a piece of fabric or vertically, or you can actually butt them all next up to each other when you're stitching them. Like, put the next pattern right next to each other, and they will all blend together. It's just the four different tones of the same photograph.
Yeah, it's just really creative. And that's all cross-stitch. That's full-coverage cross-stitch.
Yeah, that's all full-coverage cross-stitch. Yeah, I think, pretty sure that flower is actually in my aunt's garden, and then I played in Photoshop with it to make it all those wild colors.
Oh, okay. I was going to ask whose garden that came out of.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that was my aunt's garden. Yeah, I don't garden. I live in a city that's full of gardens, so I take full advantage of that.
And then we got to wrap up here, but the poppies, the Lest We Forget series.
Oh, right. Yeah.
That one, that's moving.
Yeah. Like, that was actually one of my first collections that I did, just because, like, I actually ended up launching my first set of patterns on Remembrance Day. Was it 2015? So that was important for me to have some poppy patterns, because a lot, I've seen some really nice like Remembrance Day type patterns, but there didn't seem to be that many. And a lot of them were just kind of a little bit sort of cliche and things like that. So some of them are based on some photographs that I took when I was over in Europe doing battlefield tours with the military college or elsewhere. Others are just sort of designed. So yeah, it was important for me to have like a small collection of them available just for people, especially as I am a veteran and whatnot. So I'm sort of coming at it from two angles.
Right. Well, the minute I saw that, I could think of numerous people who, could really benefit or and or just make an excellent gift.
Yeah, I've actually had a few people buying them to give to legions, which is really cool.
Yes, yes. No, those are really great designs. That was powerful there. That one just made me stop. That was really good. Yep.
Thank you.
Dana, thank you. This has been fun.
Lovely to talk to you.
Yeah, really, really enjoyed it. Thank you.
From trikes to stabbing things.
Yeah, we got it all in. Darn right. All right, so that's peacockandfig.com. And as always, links on the page for the podcasters, Facebook, Instagram, the whole bit. Dana Batho, thank you so much. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a blast.
And Christine and I will be back on Wednesday.